the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another.
That's our intro music this week on the Heritage Radio Farm Report. We have a very special guest, a very good friend of Heritage, Mario Fantasma. Mario, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. I bet you you're sitting over there in Missouri in Trimble with a nice Crown Royal. I know that's your drink.
I'm sorry?
I said I bet you're sitting there in Trimble with a nice Crown Royal. I know that's your drink.
Well, not yet anyway.
Uh-huh. Now
it will be.
The Fantasmas run Paradise Locker Meats, for all our listeners who aren't familiar with you already or who haven't already enjoyed the fruits of your labor, in Trimble, Missouri. And the word Fantasma means ghost in Italian, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
My etymology is correct. So basically, the Farm Report canvasses American farmers to bring to the consumer, you know, the farmers in their own voice. And today we're sort of doing a special, like a post-production special on the distributors and the slaughterhouses to sort of get their voice on the food movement and on what they're doing. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the day-to-day operations of Paradise Locker Meats and what you guys do?
Well, we basically started out doing custom work for local farmers here. And then when we began doing the business with Heritage Foods, again, we just kind of continued that same thing. They contacted farmers and wanted to start this pork production with local farmers. And so it fit right into our realm, and that's what we've been doing.
So is it you guys that scout and go out and find the farmers? Is that how it worked before Heritage came along? Or how did you guys find the farmers that were producing the kind of meat that met your standards?
Well, the farmers actually found us. You know, we are a small butcher shop, and like I said, you know, to begin with, we were a community-style butcher shop. So we handle all the local farmers, and they've always had very, very good products. You know, they small farms like this, they take extra care in what they raise and how they feed their animals, and it just produces excellent product.
So why do you think Heritage chose you guys? I mean, what sets you guys apart from the normal slaughterhouse?
Well, we can pay attention to detail for Heritage Foods, especially for the cuts that the chefs like. You know, we'll go in and we customize what they want done.
Weekly?
So, yes, on a weekly basis. So every week it changes.
Could it be done even daily? Like, for example, could someone call you and say, oh, I don't know, the fatty crab needs so many cuts of this kind of meat, and you could you do it pretty much on the spot?
Well, that's a little more difficult because we, you know, they bring in a certain amount of hogs from the farmers, and they try to judge what they can do and what they can sell for the farmers. And so we kind of need a little bit of head, you know, a little bit of notice on this stuff, about a week's notice usually.
Okay.
Try to get the orders in, you know, the week before or, you know, a couple of days before we actually cut the hogs. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, I know a lot of our listeners have probably seen film portrayals of slaughterhouses or have some idea of what goes on in them. But why don't you explain to us on a technical level some of the tools and some of the, you know, some of the equipment that you use to get these specific cuts and what goes into, you know, this final product that the consumer gets on their table? What is some of the machinery and some of the devices used to make it?
Well, first of all, we use a scalder in the butchering process. And that's the actual kill of the animal. We use the scalder to get all the hair off the carcasses, and then we sanitize the carcasses prior to them being cut up. The refrigeration equipment's important. We use the we beefed up our coolers to handle the amount of product that goes in. So right now the product's getting chilled within about 14 hours from about 103 degrees down to 40 degrees internal temperature.
Okay.
When the products come through and go on the cutting tables, we have saws. We've had to invest money into different pieces of equipment to make our job a little bit easier. You know, we have hand skinners, and then we have belly skinners, and, of course, the saws and the grinders and that kind of equipment.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So now, before you can even get to that phase, you get the animals live from the farm before slaughter. And I understand Patrick tells me a couple times, even recently, the animals have escaped.
Well, we just had one escape from us the other day. He slipped underneath the truck, and then the chase was on. So, fortunately, we have a 5-acre field and around us, so we were able to get the hog back safely.
What about the first time that an animal escaped?
Oh no! Yeah, he. You mean when I first opened?
Well, I thought you had two escapes.
The first shop that we had, it was burnt down in 2002, and the first animal I got, and that was back in 1995, a gentleman brought a steer over, and it was pretty crazy and very skittish, and the animal went right through the roof where our holding pen area was, so we had to go chase that animal down close by Smithville Lake, so it was kind of, wow. It was... That was the very first one I had to do, and that was pretty crazy. So,
so I read an article about you guys in the New York Times recently, or actually I think it was something like in February, and it was talking about the alarming, like the staggering expansion that you guys have undergone since 2003. If I understand correctly, you guys had 5 employees in 2003, right?
That's correct.
And now you're pushing 25.
Yes.
So... Can you explain to us a little bit how you expanded so much and so quickly, what initiatives you took to expand, who were the biggest players in this expansion, and in short, how and why you're doing so much more business?
Well, you know, when we first started and I originally built this place, I was planning on doing about 10 hogs and 10 beef a week, and depending on deer season during the fall and also the retail business. So it didn't take a lot of people to do that much work, and when we actually became state inspected at that time, so we were starting to get a few requests for some inspected products, and then Heritage came along, and that kind of changed everything. You know, our building was big enough, and at this point, you know, what we're doing today, I have no idea how we're doing it. It's totally insane. I mean, we just kind of adapt. You know, you just kind of adapt to the situation and then the business, and we know when to say no. We know when we are pushing our limits. And
so you have more demand for business than you can actually fulfill.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Why do you think so many people are looking to you guys? I mean, aren't slaughterhouses fairly common?
Yes, they are, but there have been a lot of small slaughterhouses that have gone out of business, whether it was, you know, families didn't want to continue to run the business or, you know, whatever the case was, you know, people retiring. And I think that was the biggest thing, was the people retiring and nobody really wanted to buy into the business. It's hard work.
Right.
You know, it's not an easy job to do, and it takes a lot of... it does. It takes a lot of work to keep this thing going and keep up with everything and the rising cost of everything. So I guess you got to be a little bit crazy to do this thing.
But you think also that it's your ability to fit the specific orders of distributors that also makes you an attractive candidate for their business? I mean, sometimes I hear Patrick on the phone telling you guys what he needs, like almost on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, and you guys bend and flex the orders accordingly, right?
Yes, we do.
Okay, and yeah. Is that common among slaughterhouses? Or?
Not really. Most slaughterhouses have certain ways that they do things. You know, they let's say they bring a hog in and they go through lines and they butcher all these animals and everything gets done exactly the same way throughout the whole system. So they have... predetermined cuts that they're going to make, whereas we here we just do what the chefs want or what our customers want.
It's more of a slow food
what Heritage wants. Yeah, so it's a little bit different. We're more of a hands-on type company.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what would you say is the state of the American slaughter business? I mean, how has this industry changed in the years since you have been a practitioner? I mean, even since 2003, since this staggering expansion began, what kind of changes have you seen in the overall landscape of the industry?
What I've seen more than anything is the demand for locally raised products from small farms. you know, people are more interested in that. You know, they want to know where their product's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So that in itself is kind of opened up the doors for small farms to be able to produce the products and get them sold. You know, for a long time, small farms have been being pushed out of the agriculture business.
Sure, dropping off the map.
Absolutely, and you know, and I think that just the marketing that Heritage has done over the last 5 or 6 years, and promoting these products and pushing for these products to be reestablished, basically, and. I think that all that has a big effect on why we're doing what we're doing today.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of relationship do you have with government legislation? Are there bureaucratic impediments that keep you from doing your business the way you'd like to? Are there corners that big slaughterhouses can cut that you can't?
You know, it's really different. You know, what we do is so different than what the large slaughterhouses do. That, and really, the government, they really, we don't have an issue with them at this point.
Huh.
You know, with what we're doing here, you know, we're doing it on a smaller scale, obviously, but you know, we don't get a lot of resistance from the government or from anybody else, for that matter. You know, I think that our inspectors here appreciate us being here. You know, it's obviously they have their job to do, and we have ours, and you know, we all want to make a good product, and we want it, you know, we want it to go out the door and that's in good shape and healthy for our customers.
And what are the protocols for these inspections? I mean, what kinds of standards do you guys have to meet from the federal government?
It's all FSIS, USDA regulations. We have to meet all those regulations, and basically it's the same regulations as the large slaughterhouses have to follow.
And do they?
Yes, they do, for the most part. Yes, they do. I mean, and I can't, you know, I couldn't say that they don't. I really don't know. I mean, everybody has their own HACCP plan that they follow. And that's where it's coming down. You know, you're accountable for what goes out your building and out your business. So we have to follow our HACCP plan. They have to follow theirs. And, you know, there's I'm sure there's things that slip through the cracks here and there. But, you know, those are mistakes. We're all human, and we make those mistakes. But, you know, the key is to follow your HACCP plan and make sure that your product's going out the door.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, You touched upon briefly the whole animal movement that is sort of taking over the meat market in the United States. People have become more conscious of consuming the whole animal, not just the prime cuts, you know, and chefs have been working on preparations to bring, you know, the best flavor out of the off cuts and to not waste any of the animal. I mean, how much of a role has this new philosophy played in your recent success as a provider of every cut? I mean, how much more work does it give you to have to not just cut a couple parts of the animal?
It's a lot of extra work.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's, you know, the ears get used, the tails get used, the feet, the, you know, the livers, the tongues, the hearts, all these pieces that are considered offal that, you know, that a lot of people don't like. Well, you know, what's great about it is the chefs, you know, what they're doing with it is amazing. You know, they're really creating some neat stuff with this, you know, even, you know, I hate liver, but I eat it now, you know.
Right. What's your favorite off cut?
You know, I tried the pork tongue, and I also tried the pork heart, and I was very, very impressed with both of those.
Which farmers?
You know, it really didn't matter which farmer that's bringing them in. I mean, all the farmers that are bringing the pork in, whether it's Berkshire or the Duroc or the Red Wattle or even the Tamworth, they all have one thing in common. They're all outdoor raised and dirt raised, and the meat quality's there.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just fantastic pork. So I think what these guys do with their animals is what makes the off part so good.
And what's your favorite of those breeds and why?
You know, to be honest with you, I really don't have a favorite. I like them all. I just like the reason, you know, the way they're fed. They carry much more fat than the commodity porks do. And to me, that's what brings the flavor out in the pork. Mm-hmm. You know, the intermuscular fat, the natural intermuscular fat, the fat back on the hogs, you know, when they're coming in with an inch and a quarter, inch and a half of back fat on them, it just shows me that those animals were cared for and they were fed very well. Uh-huh. And so whether it's the Burk or the Red Wattle or even the Duroc, you know, it's...
they'll all do.
They I like them all.
Gotcha. So we have a couple minutes left, so I want to shift back to Paradise Locker and ask you what your 5 and 10 year plans are. I mean, if you've grown this much in 5 years, where do you see yourself in the next 5 years? Do you want to absorb even more growth, or do you want to kind of stay where you are?
Well, actually, we'd like to we are working on some plans right now to expand. We would like to have a warehouse here, you know, for the local farmers, of course, and just to have some more space and maybe even do a little more slaughtering, a little more cutting, and maybe improve our numbers here a little bit and help out some more farmers getting their product on the table. An expansion is in the picture here. Within the next 5 years, I'd like to see this completed and, you know, actually have a physical warehouse to where trucks can actually back up to and load and unload and do the things that we would like to do, you know, improve on our smoke products and
oh, you guys make some do some in-house smoking?
Oh yeah, yeah, we're doing that right now.
And what other in-house preparations do you guys take on?
Oh shoot, we do FedEx shipping. We do curing and smoking of products. We do all the custom work. We do specialized sausages. We do an array of things. You know, we have to be diverse, though,
gotcha.
In this business. You know,
gotcha.
We have to do a lot of different things, which kind of makes things hectic. So
I can imagine. So, and looking at the bigger picture, what's the future you think of the American slaughter business and of the American sort of slow meat movement? I mean, do you think it's going to keep taking off, or do you think it's gonna hit a ceiling at some point? Where do you see the American meat processing industry being in 5 and 10 years?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to hit a ceiling. I think this is increasing. You know, the momentum's there right now, and it's increasing. You know, especially in this day and age, with the way the economy is, you know, our business has been strong. We've been doing well. We've been doing a lot of animals, a consistent amount of animals every week. So, you know, I see this to even get bigger. You know, I really do. I think this is something that people are not just, this is not just a fad. You know, mm-hmm. this is what people eat every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the importance of what they eat and knowing where it comes from is going to override everything else.
And do you think we'll be able to get the price points of these better products down so that they're a little more comparable to the mass-produced meat?
Well, you know, that's another problem, too. You know, what it takes for small farmers to produce pork it's just cost them a lot more than it does for the large factory farms.
Right.
You know, they have the volumes. They could run stuff cheaper. And the small farms, you know, we're using 8, 9, 10 different small farmers here, you know, for the heritage products and for selling our own products here at our store. So, you know, at some point, I would think that we would see a little bit of a price decrease. But, you know, the American public has been enjoying cheap food for years and years and years.
Right.
And, and it's been at pretty much at the expense of the farmer. And and I think the farmer deserves more.
I agree with you. Well, I want to thank you profoundly for joining us on the show. This is a really informative, really good program. And we want you to keep up the good work that you're doing over there at Paradise Locker.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.
Okay. Well, you're definitely a friend of the network, so I'm sure we'll have you on many more times to come.
Okay. Be looking forward to it.
Bye, Mario.
Okay, Lorenzo. Bye-bye.
We're back, little Beastie Boys, for your ears, Heritage Radio Network, Friday, June 26th, Farm Report, Section 2, with Dan and Will Purdy. How are you guys?
Hey, how you doing?
Dan's joining us from Sherbourne, New York, is that right?
That's right, yeah, we're from Sherbourne, New York. My brother's not on the phone as of yet. I presume we're going to be talking about the meat aspect. But yeah, Sherbourne, New York, which is right in the heart of the state. I've pretty much been lived here my whole life and whatnot. My family's originally from Long Island, but moved here in the early 60s.
Okay. And you guys are basically a distributor and manufacturer of high-quality meat products, right?
Yeah, our company is very, very diverse, and there's really three aspects. We are a federally inspected third-party audited company.
Okay.
And we're distributors and manufacturers of many things, you know, everything from commodity, pork, beef, poultry, seafoods, right to all natural hanging, you know, rail hanging carcass. And we manufacture many of these items and distribute them to high-end restaurants, institutions, colleges, and we also manufacture for many redistributors.
Gotcha. So did you get a chance to hear our first farm report with Mr. Fantasma of Paradise Locker?
I'm sorry, what's that, sir?
Did you get a chance to hear our first farm report today with Mr.
I listened to the very end. Unfortunately, I was on a couple business calls that I had to take, but I listened to a little bit of at the end, and it was interesting, some of his perspective from where he's at, you know, compared to New York, you know, New York State.
So how does a business like yours connect with a slaughterhouse like his? I mean, where do your businesses intersect? I understand you guys don't do your own slaughtering, right?
As of right now, we don't. When we get into some of our short and long-term goals, I'll be discussing that. But as of right now, we do not slaughter. However, we outsource the slaughter to a couple different facilities that are, you know, in the region and whatnot.
Okay. So when you say you're a manufacturer, what does that entail? I mean, you get the cut orders from restaurants, and then you send those orders over to the slaughterhouse, or how do you determine essentially the final product?
Well, how the whole system works is basically when we need an all natural, you know, all natural animals and things of that nature, we do the farm sourcing. Like I was saying, we have many aspects of our business. One aspect is called Excelsior All Natural, and that division of our company, what we do is we farm source. We go around everywhere in central New York and to the Finger Lakes, and we hook up with farmers that grow everything from, you know, vegetables to beans to hogs and beef.
Okay.
And you're asking as far as the processing aspect. So let's say we have someone who wants, a customer who wants 10 hogs manufactured. We'll call up farms, and we'll make sure that they're of the quality that we expect, and we'll have them hauled to slaughter. Slaughter will have them prepared for us, and then we, due to the fact we have distribution networks, our truck picks them up and brings them to our facility. We'll have instructions from the customer of how they want those animals cut, and we will do it to their spec. We'll manufacture it to exactly the way they want it, cut, wrapped, you know, labeled with the farm source on it, and, you know, ready for reshipment.
And, I mean, how flexible can your ordering schedule get? I mean, do you have to have your orders, like what kind of cuts they want per week, or can you even do it on a day-to-day basis?
As far as, you know, what's the timeline in which I need to make that happen?
Yeah, I mean, say a restaurant says, you know what, we need 35 of this off-cut. I mean, can you make that happen in a day or two, or do you need, or is it like a weekly order basis?
Yeah, from farm source to end product is about a week and a half to two.
Okay.
But we pride ourselves, and one of our successes has been that we're able to have that turnaround. Like, for instance, when hogs come in here, let's say 20 hogs come, and we have customers, you know, redistributors out in Boston and in near the Finger Lakes and different things of that nature, I can receive product on a Monday, manufacture it on a Tuesday and have it ready for shipment Tuesday afternoon.
Huh.
It's
so farm to table, it could in theory be 3 or 4 days, 5 days.
What's that?
So farm to table, it could in theory be 3 or 4 days.
No, from the farm to the table is about a week and a half.
Okay.
Because you have to order the hogs, have them ready, make sure they're of the the proper weight and different things of that nature. They get trucked to the slaughter. The slaughter takes 24 hours, and then we have to let them hang there for a minimum 24 hours. And then the day it hits our door, the very next day, we're manufacturing that product.
I see. And so now you guys have certain standards on what farmers you'll actually even take on as customers, right? I mean,
if a major
corporate or big business farm asked you guys to slaughter animals for them, would you take on their business?
We as far as standards go for a farm, I'm having a little hard time hearing you.
Oh, you are? Okay. I'll speak louder.
It's okay. It's probably my phone. It's thunderstorming here. So. Yeah. As far as our farms and how we source from there, yes, there is a definite criteria. We go through a third-party audit process in order for us to, manufacture our products and have them distributed into large corporations such as Sodexo or Compass Group or someone like that. So we are a third-party audited company. Third-party audited company is basically making sure that our food safety practices are of the highest, quality
standards
and assurance. So when we go to farms and folks like that, we don't try to put the whole corporate thing in front of their face, but we make sure that they're doing things with good food safety practices. We make sure that first off, if it's hogs or beef or something, that they're raising them in a humane manner. We're pretty specific as far as the breed, Berkshire Duroc.
Pretty much only process heritage breeds.
What's that?
You guys pretty much only manufacture heritage breeds, huh?
They're mixed breeds. I mean, it's a Berkshire Duroc, Old Chester
hybrid.
Mix. Yeah, exactly, hybrids. We make sure that they, that they're able to be in pasture and different things of that nature. We have a weight that we're looking for. It's about 18 weeks, and they hang at about 200 pounds and things of that nature. That's far as the whole carcass animal. As far as, sourcing products, of other nature, like an organic bean or a granola or something that we do distribute to the colleges, we make sure that their practices as well have food safety, that they have proper labeling, they have rodent control, they have food safety aspects in place.
Sure. So it's basically guys like you that are helping this whole animal movement sort of gain ahead of steam. I mean, you guys facilitate the farmers and the consumers in so far as you prevent off cuts from being wasted, right? I mean, you guys pretty much cut the whole animal, right? And find a home for the whole animal.
Absolutely. It's everything but the squeal. I mean, from head to tail, is utilized.
And what's your favorite off cut?
I'm sorry, what's that?
What's your favorite off cut?
Oh, many. I mean, I love the jowl and into sausage and different things. I'm a rib guy. I like that. I've been turned on to some really good head cheese and things of that nature.
And talk to me about the mutually beneficial relationship that you have with small heritage farmers. I mean, they couldn't survive without you, and you couldn't survive without them. How do you guys work together to get this product to the consumer, and what are you doing to popularize heritage breeds?
Well, it is a relationship, and what I try, how I'm trying to build the movement is through commitment of the end user.
Uh-huh.
I have a contract with up to 10 colleges in the area, and so what we're trying to develop is a certain percentage of products, local products and proteins that are utilized in these facilities. And a lot of times, in the corporate world, which, somewhat I'm dealing with, there's a lot of talk, but So make it happen is another thing. So we work real hard into upholding a very, very high standard as far as quality. So when something is delivered, they'll want that product again. So as far as relational goes between us and the farmer, we work really hard together to make sure that we can live up to the commitments that people are asking for. And on the other side, you know, asking for those commitments from the end user. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, when do you need more pork? When do you need more beef?
Uh-huh.
You know, when's the next time? How was the product? Always getting feedback of every aspect, making sure that everything along the line works in a very, very high quality way.
Uh-huh. And staying on this line of sort of helping the food movement gain steam, I mean, as far as corporations and legislators go, they say they want to grow green and they say they want to go local, but why don't you tell us a little bit about what you've noticed being on the ground with how corporations and legislators are responding to this green move, to this green sustainable locavore movement?
Yeah, it's a little tricky in the way that, and I don't know if tricky is the right word, but everybody's obviously talking about it. It's the buzzword, and so, you know, everybody's, wanting to, advertise the fact that, we're all about the green movement, we're all about all natural, we're all about supporting local. And for some facilities, that is very, very true, and they're all about it, especially the chefs. I mean, the chefs are all about it. They want it.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be able to utilize, their neighbor's products and the community's products, because, you know, it's a sense of pride and quality.
It's so in vogue now, and there's a more educated consumer base. It's almost like if you don't do it this way, you're going to lose some business.
Right, you know. But when you get into the corporate structure, and I've been in many, many meetings where it's, snickered about, basically saying, we're only doing this for political reasons.
Right.
And so there's a major disconnect between, the people on the ground, like the chefs and the farmers and myself wanting, these things to happen, all the way to the corporate ladder where, you just can't stop that giant wheel. Can't stop the giant wheel. They don't have time to pick up the napkin, and they're doing and saying things just to make sure that they can say they're talking about it, type thing. So it is a little frustrating, but, I do know for a fact that the more we work it, the more we come across with the quality goods, the more that people have knowledge of what's going on and the end user demanding it more and more and more, and building the infrastructure to make it happen,
mm-hmm.
it'll happen more and more. It'll happen. And
so,
it won't be talking points, it'll be reality.
Actions. So in the years that you've been involved with the meat industry in the United States, what changes besides this sort of local-centric philosophy have you seen it undergo? I mean, how far has it come? What are some of the big differences in the meat industry in now as opposed to, say, at the turn of the millennium?
In the all-natural movement or...
Yeah, in the meat industry in general.
Okay, and recently, is that,
in the past, decade, let's say.
Now.
Yeah. Or even since you've been running this company, or since you've taken the reins of this company.
Yeah. Well, there's, there's so many things that are changing, obviously, today and stuff. But, what I see is, in the good aspects of things, is that the consumer wants to know. There was a time, I know my parents' generation, my mother could walk into a store and she could go to the meat case and she could look at the meat case and know what cuts were what was of quality grade,
mm-hmm.
What the value of a particular item was.
Uh-huh.
And then in the 80s and the 90s, your average parent or, mother or father would just go to the case not knowing what the heck it was,
mm-hmm.
simply looking at a price, saying, I'll get that because I can feed my three kids for, $10.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what they were purchasing. They didn't know anything of quality or cuts or anything. Well, I believe that the desire to be educated, you know, from the consumer, mm-hmm. they want to know where their food came from. They want to know, you know, what's in it. They want to make sure that they're eating healthy and things of that nature. So I think that that's been, a turnaround in the last, 10 years, I'll say, or five to 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And in a sense, it's almost followed the economic boom in America. I mean, if you think about the 80s and 90s, I mean, that's when the mass production model came into the equation. And now, economically, as we move backwards, it's sort of bringing us back to a more antiquated method of eating, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're correct. And I always said, this movement's going to find out if this is, a real thing in people's hearts is when things turn south, are they going to sell their body for, that dime a pound,
uh-huh.
Or whatever, but, other aspects as far as, the industry is, well, I see more and more, and I don't know, the older I get, the more conspiracists I think, but, some of the aspects I see is I do believe government wants to control food more and more and more.
Sure.
And, it's power. Money's power, food's power, energy's power. Those things are power, and I think it's a sort of control.
Uh-huh.
And we've gone through third-party auditing, federal inspection, different things of that nature. We've kept up with the times. There's many, many facilities that in my area that were in business 20 years ago that just they're not anymore.
Just dropped off the map.
What's that?
They just dropped off the map.
They can't take on the regulations required to keep with the federal regs. Hmm. I mean, the paperwork and different things.
And it costs a lot more money too, right?
Oh yeah, time and effort. And frankly, there's a lot of people in this industry are a certain breed.
Uh-huh.
They're not going to necessarily sit down at a desk and take 2 hours to figure out their, where their deviations in their HACCP plan was this week.
Uh huh.
I've been fortunate enough to have good people working with me in my company and to develop a very, very good HACCP plan and to become third-party audited and to follow all the rules and regs. But frankly, in my area, it's rare.
I gotcha. Well, I mean, hopefully this movement will continue to grow, and it's because of players like you that it's growing and will continue to do so. But listen, I want to shift gears for 1 second. I want to see if we can get your brother on the phone here because I want to plug your show. That
absolutely.
We got coming up on HRN here.
Absolutely.
The Purdy's are abstract musicians and abstract music producers, and they're going to do sort of a DJ/sustainable movement talk show. Is that right?
Absolutely. Our show is going to be all about what we do here in the industry and all about what me and my brother have developed throughout our whole life as far as music. We've been musicians our whole life, and we've pretty much. Created our own little musical world and everything from dream pop to punk to, many, many different aspects. And so we're really excited about displaying, what we do here.
Okay. And your show's going to start airing in about 10 days, right?
That's right. Yep. I believe it's on a Thursday night.
Okay. All right. So look out for the Purdy's show, music DJ set, and sustainable food movement talk radio.
You got it. We've come across a good name that we're going to be utilizing. It's Custom Cuts of Meat and Music.
Okay, I like that.
You got it. I wanted to introduce my brother Bill here, and he's going to be definitely directing a good portion of the show and whatnot.
Well, hey, Bill. How are you?
Hi. It's going to be a good show, fun and informative, kind of like a day in the life. Producers of fine foods and great eclectic wild music.
Yeah, no, I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm pumped. I think it's going to be good. And our listeners should look out for it starting about 10 days from now, 2 weeks.
Yes. Yep.
Great. Well, to the Purdy's, we'd like to extend a big Heritage Radio Network thank you. And
thank you.
We can't wait for our premiere show.
I appreciate your time very
much. All right.
Much.
Bye, Dan. Bye, Bill.
Thanks.
Take
Thanks,
care.
Thanks, Lorenzo. Bye.
I am a lineman for the county. and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for a